food here or something to
ice cream.
Yeah, I got something back here. I got to look at my list of people. There we go. That's better. Well, everyone, welcome to the September meeting of the Ashland Housing and Human Services Commission. The first thing on our agenda, I'm sure we have a quorum. So the first thing is approval of the minutes. They were pretty direct. Did everybody get a chance to read those and make a recommendation if there's any changes?
I only have one change to make. The change is that my name was spelled incorrectly, that's all. It's M-A-H-A-N.
Oh, yeah, it was.
It's okay.
I'll fix it right now.
Thank you.
Thanks, Liz. Would anybody like to make a motion that we accept the minutes from our last meeting?
A motion.
Okay, Gina made a motion to accept this as our second.
I'll second.
As amended.
As amended, right,
yep.
With the correct name correction. All those in favor, let's see how we do that. We're going to be doing this a bunch. All those in favor, raise your hand. Okay, any opposed? Any abstentions? Oh, the minutes are accepted. Our next point on the agenda is the public forum, and we did have one printed email from a person who wanted to deliver that. Did everybody see that particular
email?
I see Linda nodding. I don't know that we have to read it. It did alert us to the need for emergency housing coming out of the fire and had some recommendations for programs, or particularly there was, it went to the Planning Commission and then Brandon sent it to us, but it did have zoning issues, which we may or may not really have much to do with.
It was the thing from Molly Silver, is that right?
Yes, right.
And she mentions what Darby in Talent just sort of publicized in the last 24 hours with adding some flexibility to their urban growth boundary and their land use, which I had seen a little bit earlier today and immediately thought, well, that might be a good idea for Ashland. I was glad to see the link in that communication from Molly. It made it quite handy to find that decision from Talent.
Well, I think we can note that we got that. We can pay attention to that issue. I know we will be going forward. We have 3 hours of very intense meeting for us going forward. So unless there's other people that want to, do we have anybody else that wants to speak at the public forum as opposed to the review and revision of the housing recommendations? So the third thing on the agenda is the Housing Trust Fund, and this is an hour-long discussion that is got a lot in it, of the Housing Trust Fund review and recommendations. And so we did have a fairly significant packet with that. And so, Linda, do you want to lead us through that discussion?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as it was outlined in the memo that you all received, this item is coming back before you because if you'll remember when you made a recommendation, it was in March, right when things were just starting with COVID and things were really up in the air for the grantees and for the city, and we didn't really know how we were going to address the needs, and that potentially, you know, the Affordable Housing Trust Fund might be one way. And so at that time, you did make a recommendation regarding funding ORA and their winter shelter program, and then also NeighborWorks Umpqua. And so in that time, we did end up using a little bit of the Affordable Housing Trust funds, and you can see that in your memo. But then very quickly, we also received a bunch of new information around how we could use the CDBG funding more flexibly. And then we also received some additional CDBG funding. And so we were able to address most of those emergent needs with that funding source. And we were able to preserve affordable housing trust funds. In the meantime, we were also told that FEMA would have money available to provide for some of the non-congregate sheltering needs. And Brandon was the lead staff person on that funding source. And he did submit a pre-application for reimbursement and was awarded. And the information about the FEMA funds was that because it is a federal funding source, it cannot be used, or, well, I guess I should back up. FEMA is only a reimbursement. The city would need to pay for any of the costs up front and then would submit those costs for reimbursement to FEMA and would receive 75% in reimbursement. But that the city could not use another federal funding source as that fund that gets reimbursed. So any activities that were funded with CDBG money would not be eligible to receive the FEMA reimbursement. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. So the reason this is coming before you now is that we are heading into the winter shelter season, and due to COVID and just everything that has happened, ORA has had to find a new way of addressing the winter shelter needs for the community. So they submitted a request which amends their, well, doesn't amend, replaces their old request that was recommended by you. But because we needed to come back and consider this request, we also opened it up to the previous grantees to allow them to also speak to their projects in this second consideration. The other thing is that Maslow Project has come forward with a request as well. And originally they were requesting CDBG funding, but due to the FEMA reimbursement issue and the fact that their program may be able to be submitted for non-congregate shelter reimbursement through FEMA, we thought it would be best to put it into the same funding recommendation and see how you guys felt about that. So those are the new applications that are before you. And I don't know if we want to go ahead and hear from the applicants and or talk about those applications and have a question and answer, or if you want me to talk further. What is your pleasure, Rich?
Well, here's I see Heidi's hands. I would like us to just have some general questions if people have them. One of the questions that I have, and then I'll let Heidi do the next one, is are we clear that the March recommendations are just out now, even while we might reconsider them again, that there's nothing in the recommendations that we made before that binds us or anything? That's just happened and it didn't happen, right?
Well, I think at this point, you know, you could make the same recommendation. I mean, you could say, you know, I recommend right. that ORA receive $110,000 and NeighborWorks Umpqua receive $43,500. And then we would just forward that to the council. Because your last recommendation didn't go to the council, we sort of have that time because it will go to the council now.
Right, but there's nothing tying us to that previous one. We're kind of starting over in some ways. Okay. And Heidi, you want to go? And then Jackie, and then Tom.
Yes. I had a question about how the Housing Trust Fund monies are replenished when FEMA grants the recipient, or the, I assume they have to put in an application for those funds. And do we know how, what the process is, how we're reimbursed?
Once the city council makes an award of housing trust funds, if it's an award for COVID related activities that are reimbursable under that emergency declaration, then the city would itemize those expenses that relate to the COVID response that are eligible for reimbursement, and submit a request to FEMA to reimburse for those damages. They use the term damages because typically it's a hurricane or a flood or something that causes damage. But in this case, in the case of getting pre-approval for non-congregate shelter, we would have to go through that step again. Linda indicated we've gone through it, but it is a 30-day period that you'd have to go through each 30 days in order to ensure that Jackson County's public health declaration still identified that housing homeless people in a non-congregate manner was necessary for public health. And so at each 30-day interval, that would be reassessed. I know one of the applicants before you is for a 5-month period, and so we would be in a position to seek reimbursements for non-congregate housing for whatever period of time the declaration of emergency remained. And then the FEMA would reimburse the city, as Linda indicated, at 75% of the money from the city's general fund that was obligated to that use. And we could not obligate community development block grants and receive any kind of reimbursement on those funds, because that would be effectively double dipping of federal money.
Okay, so Jackie, you're next.
Okay, I want to be clear on the revisions that I saw, that Aura did a revision to 190, 223, and then they did another revision when they were able to get the rent lowered, is that right, with the shelter, with the church? Mm-hmm. So now they're looking at, is it about 173?
Yeah, I have 173,983.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Tom?
My question is, are we considering the Tolman Creek proposal?
That's a good question. I did talk with Sean Darrell, who is the developer of the Tolman Creek development, and he did request to have his project removed.
Okay.
He doesn't feel like competing in this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we take the next step in this? Okay, Linda, so do you have, we've all read the proposal. Should we take testimony at this point?
Sure.
Okay, so can we, we've all had a chance to read the proposals again, and at this point, we're going to hear from applicants about that. And Michelle and others are there from ORA. Can you bring them in now?
So would you like me to bring them each in, or would you like to bring in each speaker one at a time?
Oh, well, I would say bring speakers in one at a time, and they can then.
So who would be the first speaker on the speaker request list?
Well, I was going to go with ORA first. So I don't have the list, but it doesn't seem like we have to do that. Let's hear ORA, and then we can hear Maslow, right?
Yeah, let me see who is the representative.
It would be
ORA.
Michelle.
So cute. I don't know.
There's Michelle.
And was there somebody else from ORA on the speaker request list?
Yeah, their executive director was on there.
I'm here.
Is there somebody else, Michelle, from your organization?
I'm not sure if Diane was going to come in or not. Diane,
she was on the list. But if she's not, Michelle, just go ahead.
Okay.
She's not in the attendees at this point. So.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Michelle Arellano, Executive Director of AURA. It's great to see all of your faces. So we have really gone through the full gamut of looking to provide a shelter that was as safe as possible during the pandemic. And we were looking at a hotel for a while, and that ended up not working out. They are selling now. And so Calvin Hall is really a great option for us. It gives us so much more space. There's no way that we could have held the shelter at our Main Street location because we just didn't have the space. We'd maybe be able to get 15 people in there with the social distancing of 6 feet apart. And so we are now looking at Calvin Hall. We have their board has approved it, and so it's in the submittal. We're able to house 40 people social distanced for the entire shelter season. The other good part of that is that there's breakout rooms. So there's 5 breakout classrooms. And so if somebody is sick but doesn't test positive for COVID, or they're high risk and they need to isolate, we'll have these rooms for them to isolate that night, which will make it a lot safer. We'll have staff there. We're not able to do volunteers any longer. And so we'll have staff there all night, and we'll also have a fire watch. We're looking at opening the shelter season the 1st of November, as soon as we can get everything approved. We will start the intake at our resource center and signing our guests up for the winter season. It'll run like last year. Once they're signed up, they have a bed for the entire season. If as long as, you know, they're able to follow the guidelines of the facility, just being respectful and wanting to stay there. So we really are looking at this proposal based around the pandemic and everything that we need to add to keep people as safe as possible. We still will be applying for funding through Access, which will be paying for the navigation and the resource center and the overhead. And this will be really covering the majority of what we need to do due to the pandemic.
Well, thank you. That was a good quick summary. We've all read the written materials. So how do we want to do we, I guess we just want to hear some questions from the board, the commission, about what their project is, but it won't be a discussion of how we fund it. Does that sound okay? So if people have a question about what the program poses to do and the application that we read, it would be available to ask that now. Is that Linda, or are you just?
No, I would like to ask a question. So just so that I understand, the program is essentially the same as last year. Moving to Calvin Hall, so it'll serve a few less people than last year, but way more than we could if we stayed where we are. We're not using volunteers anymore, so we're adding paid people into those roles for COVID safety. But other than that, the program remains the same. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
Jackie. And then Echo.
Jackie's muted.
Unmute.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm just noting the expense of the program and understanding why it's more expensive than last year. So it's not only the rent last year with the East Main property. Can you compare that with what the rent is for Calvin Hall? And the second thing, could you clarify what the $25,000 for repair and maintenance is for the shelter?
Okay, so another piece of the proposal as well is hotel rooms. And so if we need to isolate people for long term, we wanted to make sure we had rooms like we had prior, especially for the high risk population. So thanks for triggering me to remember that piece. The site at Main Street, we paid $6,000 for the entire year. And so at Calvin Hall, it is $5,500 a month. And so that is a big difference. And then the $25,000 is to secure it due to COVID. And so we have to do pipe and drape between each of the bunks. And it needs to be fire retardant. And so that cost has added up quickly in order to keep everybody safe and to set it up to where there's screens in between each of the guests.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Echo, yes.
I just have a newbie question because I don't know as much as I should yet. What were we doing in winter shelter with animals in the last couple of years?
We were allowing them to come into the shelter as long as they were leashed, mm-hmm. and that they didn't cause any problems where people felt unsafe and that they were taken care of.
And will that continue at the Presbyterian Church?
Yes.
Tom.
I have a small question about the meals. As a meal provider, I was wondering how you would, you have an expense for the small boxes, and I'm assuming that's for COVID, not to have, we used to bring big trays of food in, and how do you envision that working with, if you're having people prepare food in their home, put them in these boxes and individually. Is that the concept?
It is. It's still unfolding as we talk. Cass has been doing quite a bit of work on it. We have found out through the county that we do need the food prepared in the commercial kitchen now. The food needs to be prepared in a commercial kitchen.
Oh, okay.
So we just found that out last week. And so what we're looking to do is there's some people that can still provide through a commercial kitchen, and we can't have people grouped together. And so they'll need to be individual meals. And we're also looking into, because there is a commercial kitchen at Calvin Hall, is to possibly hiring a chef or a cook to cook and be able to individually prepare the meal. So we're still working on that to make sure that we're compliant.
Yeah, it seems very complicated to do that in a way that is consistent with the new situation we have with COVID.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
So one of my questions was about how many FTEs? It looked like you were indicating 2.8 FTEs in the project, but there must be more than that.
Yes, there is more than that. We're looking at having two navigators assigned to the shelter, and then we'll have the two people overnight. And then we possibly might need to add another person for the cooking. So it has become a new way of running the shelter.
Okay. Are there other questions, or can we move to our next applicant?
I think Chris.
Just a small question. With the hotels that we're reserving for the high risk folks, if those rooms are not being used, are we using those rooms if we have an overflow?
Yeah, depending on, that's a great question. Depending on the funding, if we're able to get the funding, we can use some of those rooms for overflow if needed. You know, we're not sure what it's going to look like in the fall when it comes to the pandemic. And so if it's safe and we feel like we can keep everybody there, we could use those for overflow as well.
Tom?
A question about the rooms. And as I remember, there was an expense for cleaning rooms after their use. And I wasn't sure how that would work if somebody is there because they've had they're being isolated. How would it be a daily thing or just after their stay?
It's after their stay. There usually needs to be a deep cleaning. Sometimes the sheets need to be changed out permanently. There could just be a few different things depending on maybe some of the challenges that our guests might be experiencing.
And have you discussed all this with the potential hotels? And
We have a few key partners that we've been working with that we are going to continue to work with through the shelter season.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I had a question.
Okay, Gina, we got a roll, though. Go ahead.
Oh, well, you know, I just, one quick one. Michelle, I'm looking on this. I didn't see insurance. Did I miss that?
We are going to charge, no, great question, Gina. We're going to charge that to the access billing.
Okay, that's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's good.
Well, thank you, Michelle. And we'll go to our next applicant, which is Maslow. And is Mary Farrell here? Is she on our list?
She is, and I will bring her in at this point. I did want to note that Linda Rapond has recused herself from the deliberation and discussion of this item. She's in the attendee group, so she's able to watch but not able to speak. But we'll bring her back in after this agenda item is over. And Mary, I'm going to bring you in right now. You should see something on your screen. Hey. Hello, Mary. Are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me okay?
We can. Thank you.
Great. Awesome. Nice to see you all. This is obviously super strange times, but appreciate the opportunity. We had originally requested support when COVID first, you know, was new and looking to get a lot of unsheltered people who are at higher risk of contracting COVID, but also more vulnerable if they have COVID. Obviously, if you're outside, it's a lot more difficult to recover. And now that some time has passed, coincidentally, since we were asked to resubmit this proposal, we also now have the fire situation. So I think a couple things have happened in that period of time. One, we have come to learn that indeed quite a few of the families that we work with have actually been tested positive for COVID. And so we have had a high utilization of families that we work with in hotels, higher than I would have thought. We have worked with several Ashland hotels over the last 10 years, namely Ashland Valley Inn, Ashland Motel, Timbers Motel, Cedarwood Motel. And we've had that opportunity to sort of develop those relationships over time. And with the fires, we now have an influx of students that were displaced from Phoenix or Talent who are now enrolling in Ashland. So we've already been inundated with new referrals, specifically that are now attending Ashland schools. So the other thing that has happened in that period of time is we have worked out a relationship contractually with Linda Rapond and her per unit, we are going to be renting three of the rooms, which are in an isolated building. So they'll be disconnected from the other rooms that she will continue to rent out as a hotel or short-term housing. But our rooms will have three. We have a $500 per room deposit, and then we'll be paying $800 a month for those per room for 6 months. And that really, the intention behind that when we started this conversation was to replace group sheltering in our facility and have some short-term shelter for either young adults who might be college-aged or like single moms with a child or two small children. Obviously, you wouldn't be able to get a large family into those rooms, but it'd be a very specific population we'd be serving. And then our proposal, so that's half, that's roughly half of the budget of what we've asked for. But then we also know we're going to have a whole bunch of other families that are going to need hoteling, especially those who were renting and they maybe didn't have renter's insurance. We already have some families who got like $1,500 payout from FEMA, and that's the grand sum of what they'll get. That's not enough to get rehoused, and it's going to take us some time before those units are available. We're going to, you know, have an urgent need to keep some of those families stable, especially once winter comes. So the other half of our budget is really just proposing nights, and it's hard to say. We don't know yet. It's not like I could say each family we put in a hotel will use it for X number of days, but some of them might be short term. Some of them could be a little bit longer term. And we're also obviously fundraising in a variety of other ways throughout the county to help with the larger population. So this is really what we anticipate the need for the Ashland community is. The only challenge I can see is there is the potential for hotel rooms to remain really full. There's a lot of people in hotel rooms right now. So whether it's Aurora residents or Maslow residents, like I think we're all going to be challenged with finding rooms to be in. So we are also working with Representative Pam Marsh on some other opportunities for some short-term or transitional type of housing, but those are super early in the works.
Great, thank you. Well, yeah. As we did with the last one, are there questions that commissioners would like to ask at this point? Well, I see echoes right up there. Go ahead.
Okay, had to unmute. I don't know any details except what I saw in the paper or on TV about SOU surprisingly opening up some dorm space to non-SOU affiliated community members.
Yep.
I have no idea what the details are on that. I haven't been able to see anything coming through my campus email. Do you know anything? Is that another possibility for some that might help relieve some of the pressure?
That's actually what I was referring to in our discussions with Pam Marsh. There's nothing. We just started the conversation yesterday, and it started with a tour of some dormitories that they're no longer using. And the idea is that we'd be looking at identifying a target population and then providing services. So if it's families, Maslow would be the ideal service provider to provide that case management and help families kind of transition through ultimately into getting housed. But I don't think there's anything, like we just started the conversation yesterday. So there's a lot of questions to be answered still, a lot of information to be had, and a lot of decisions to still be made. So that's probably why you haven't heard anything more than...
Yeah, many people had asked for various reasons about that over the last number of months and years. And the answer was always, we'd like to, but we can't. And so to see this turnaround in my former employer's position was really great to see. So good news. We'll see how it works out.
Absolutely. And it's worth noting just super fast that 100% of our budget proposal is to pay for services. We are not including any of our time, none of our services, everything else, insurance, everything else will be leveraged by other resources that we have.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. Other questions? I have one, but I'm looking for other people. So my question that I should have asked Michelle also is, what is the level of collaboration in Ashland between your organization and ORA and maybe Jobs with Justice or others that are working on homeless programs?
Absolutely, great question. And I think the easiest, probably simplest response is that, you know, if there are single adults that come, you know, we have a no wrong door policy. We'll always give people a meal or whatever it is they're seeking tangible wise. But if they're not part of a family or if they're not a child themselves, we refer them to ORA. And I think similarly, if a family was to come to ORA, I think they would meet whatever need that they could, but then make that referral to Maslow. And in pre-COVID days, we would do a lot of like our case manager would, you know, communicate with their staff, and there's a lot of cross referrals. We actually have a new case manager in Ashland starting. She actually started the day before the fires broke out, but she's from the area. She's an Ashland High graduate years ago, and she's been with Maslow for 5 or 6 years. So that'll be just a continuation of that coordination. But I believe we've always had a lot of very solid collaboration and cross referral so that we're not providing the same population with the same service.
Well, this is just my suggestion, but in addition to being clear about which who's served by each organization, it seems like you're also sort of each stepping into a new time and a new effort around motels and hotels. And I just wondered whether there's also an opportunity to share collaboration around that issue itself that isn't just individual clients. And I guess it's just a suggestion, and Michelle and y'all can work on that. But it seems to me that in this new situation, it would be good to be able to have that cooperative hotel motel plan, I guess, or at least not a plan, at least we're not competing around those things.
No, I completely hear what you're saying. That's a great suggestion. Thank you for that.
Tom?
I'm curious about your reference to campgrounds in addition to motels and hotels.
Well, there are a couple of campgrounds that will allow, usually not more than 30 days, but they will allow Maslow Project to pay for camping fees. So if they are able to stay, if they have like a trailer or, you know, a vehicle that's more suitable for camping, that would be preferable than them staying somewhere that they're not technically allowed to be. So the idea is we would only be paying for those camp spots, you know, in campgrounds where those reservations are allowed. I can tell you in Josephine County, they will not allow homeless people to reserve those spaces. And so there's very, very few throughout the two county region that will, but we do pay quite a few reservation fees for people just to have, you know, it also includes access to water and power and a bathroom. And yeah. I mean, those are pretty essential needs.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mary. That was very helpful for us. I think we do have another application, but maybe not an applicant representative. And so I think we'll move forward with at least talking about these applications at this point. Whoops.
So, Rich, I wanted to jump in and just ask the commission to consider that when you make your motion, if you could include some language that would allow staff the flexibility to identify the best funding source. I know it's been kind of complicated to explain all of that about the reimbursement and what could be allowed. And I think, you know, both projects have non-congregate sheltering in them. The Aura project has only a portion, but there are some other pieces that would have to be met in order to allow them to qualify for FEMA. And I think Brandon could expand on that if you wanted to, but I don't know that that's necessary. And so it may be that we might look at parsing it out to best leverage our resources, but it may be that we can't. So I would just encourage the commission that when you go to make a recommendation, if you could add some language that allows us that flexibility. And I don't know, Brandon might have more to add.
I have a question rather than a comment in terms of whether Linda has apprised the commission as a whole in terms of the CDBG-CB funding and a new allocation.
Yes, I haven't. So thank you for bringing that up. So as many of you know, I think we touched on it briefly at the last time we met. So the city did receive an allocation of what are called community development block grant coronavirus funds, which is part of that CARES Act allocation at the federal level. And originally we had received $104,079. And we did utilize the majority of that funding. But then we also got a waiver for some other funding. And I talked about that at the last meeting too. So last week, we were notified that the what's called the third tranche or CDBG-CB3 has been allocated by the federal government. And out of that allocation, the city received $189,741 in additional funds. And like the prior CB grant, all of this funding is subject to the what's called the mega waiver, which means it is allowed to be used as public service funding, which, you know, in our normal cycle, it's 15%, only 15% of our overall allocation is allowed for that. So it gives us a lot more leeway to use that funding. So we do have additional CDBG funding that we can address some of the needs that are presented here tonight. Obviously, some things are not allowable for CDBG funding, like the NeighborWorks Umpqua funding would not be eligible. And like I said, some might be preferable for affordable housing trust funds. But I can answer any questions you have about any of that.
Jackie. Unmute.
I need training. I was just trying to understand the ballpark in terms of all the money. So if we were just to look at Maslow, Aura, and Umpqua and add it all together and look at how much money with all the different funding sources we have, would those three proposals all be able to be fully funded with the money available? I see Rich shaking his head no.
Well, yes and no. So
yeah,
not with Affordable Housing Trust Fund money. If we split out some of it into CDBG, then we could certainly fund them all fully.
Well, that's my point. That's what I mean by the ballpark. So if there is a way that all three could be fully funded if you were looking in both the trust fund and the CDBG?
Yes, absolutely. So the majority of Aura's project is really something that I think would be probably easier for us to fund out of CDBG. The non-congregate sheltering piece, $45,000, would be the piece that we would be looking at seeing if we could get reimbursed for. I mean, we may not be able to, or there may be portions of it that we aren't able to get reimbursed for. So I think, you know, for our purposes, staff would want to get together with the individual applicants and talk with them and see how we could make those things eligible and try to leverage our money in the best way possible. And I don't know, Brandon, if you have anything you would want to add to that.
No, I think that covers it. With the $185,000 in new CDBG round 3 funds, that really does give flexibility that was not in place more than a week ago when the applicants submitted their applications.
So I just want to be clear where we are at this point. We are looking at evaluating the 3 programs that we funded in the past as to what level they are, and then we would count on the staff to look at the flexibility of which places the funds come to make that happen. Is that correct?
Yes.
Anybody?
I think that sounds accurate.
And just a minute. Linda isn't here because she can't participate in this. So the rest of us will make a decision. And I guess what I would do now is just to be really clear that we should open up to each counselor what they would like to see in terms of funding levels for each one of these programs.
Okay.
Heidi.
So I would recommend that we fully fund AURA and the Maslow project. And I think I'm a little rusty on what NeighborWorks Umpqua was, their proposal was, but I remember that it was really important for our affordable housing program for them to be funded. And so I hope that when this goes to the council, that someone will be there to explain why that's important to Ashland's affordable housing. But I would also like to fully fund their request.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Tom, you want to speak to this? Whoop, you need to do the muting.
What I said was I would echo what Heidi's recommendations are. I assume that staff could finesse these different funding sources, but that would be my position.
Jackie?
I'm unmuted, right?
Yes, yeah, you're good.
I completely agree with Heidi and with Tom. I think as long as we give the flexibility to the staff on the best funding source, I think it's a giant win-win-win.
Chris?
I'm also in agreement with everybody as well on the panel.
Okay, thank you. Echo?
Good to me.
You have any comments you want to throw in?
Nope.
Okay. And Gina, any points that you'd like to add?
You know, I'm in complete agreement with everyone, Maslow and AURA, and I really would like to be able to see Neighborhood Works Umpqua finessed in there. When we read that over, just knowing what they've done and what they're proposing, I think is awesome. So, but I am in complete agreement with everyone. And I want to see.
Well, we'll take motions in a little bit. I want to throw in my agreement.
We haven't heard from you, Rich.
Right. I was going to just say that I'm in agreement with the sounds like a consensus about what we would like to see happen. And it's easy when you don't have to take money from people. I had a question that goes to all the applicants, but I think it applies to ORA when I was reading their proposal. And in just the way that we write the proposals, that we should be clear that we can only fund one half of a program. And the applicant is responsible for raising funds for one half or more that is required by our ordinance and by law for that to happen. And the point is that when you read a grant, you have to see whether the program they describe is half funded by our thing. And it isn't just that there's another organization out there with more money that does other things. So in the case of Housing Trust Fund that would go to ORA, it would pay for one half of the winter shelter program. And if there's other things that the organization is doing, even while they have that money, that can't be the match or the program match that's needed. Is that clear to everybody? Mm-hmm. Me or Brandon, do you have?
Yeah, I think that you're exactly right in terms of the limitations and use of housing trust funds. And I think that's part of why staff wanted to work with applicants to see if in some circumstances community development block grants might be a better source, as that could be a match to leverage those housing trust funds for a given program.
I'm concerned about that a little bit, because at 173, that puts the cost of the winter shelter at, what, $350,000 program. And I was sort of hoping that some of ORA's work was apart from just the winter shelter. And so if you all can straighten that out, that would be helpful, at least for me to think about.
Yeah, I think we can definitely address that with the applicant. Another aspect of this will be staff and the commission for future allocation years working out an application process that delineates and collects the information that you need to see what that match is and from what source.
Okay, Heidi?
I would just like to remind everyone that having managed the winter shelters for many years, we did it so cost effectively because we had so much volunteer right. Labors. And had it not been that ORA took over that process, we would have not been able in this time of forest fires and people displaced from fires and homelessness and COVID, we would not have been able to house a fraction of the number of people that ORA and Maslow are able to do right now. It's a crucial and unique time in our history as a community.
So I'm all in favor of the consensus that we have. I just want to remind ourselves that a match is a very serious part of what we do, and that we need to be careful with the grant applicants about making sure that they're showing that in their grant application. So is there a recommendation or a motion to fund each of the three programs at the requested amount with the provision that the staff will come up with a funding plan that flexibly covers each one of those.
Don't move.
Jackie moved that motion.
You made it easy.
What?
You made it easy.
Oh.
I second.
Tom seconds it. We'll just do this one by voice. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
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 Any opposition? We have one, it's not an abstention, it's one person not participating. So that is covered, and I think we've made that decision. Linda or Brandon, do you want to suggest any next steps out of this?
So the next steps would be we'll take this recommendation and we will send it to the council, and staff will touch base with the applicants to talk with them and get a more official breakdown of the funding. And Tom, I see you have your hand up.
It just occurred to me that Jackie, are you still an Aura board member?
Yes.
Is this problematic? Because I remember so well our getting crosswise with the city council, and
I'm happy to have the minutes show that I have no financial gain to be made from any decisions made tonight, and that I also believe that I can make a fair and just determination of how to vote on these issues tonight.
Great. We all knew that.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Jackie. That's a good addition to the minutes. Thank you.
So this item will go before the council on October 6th. And your recommendations, and then probably a more accurate, specific breakdown will be provided.
Linda, can you send us the accurate breakdown before it goes to council?
Yes.
Thank you.
And really, that breakdown is just going to be, you know, what is going to come from what fund, or what we would recommend.
Okay, so now we're on the Affordable Housing Program Revisions, Review, and Recommendations, and Brandon is going to lead it. This is another long, detailed discussion. So, Brandon, do you want to lead that?
Yeah, thank you. I hope that because this commission had a rather extensive overview of this on back in July, that this presentation that I'm going to be providing is abbreviated to some degree, but I would note that subsequent to the Housing and Human Services Commission meeting, we had prior to the Housing and Human Services Commission meeting, we also had a study session with the Planning Commission and the City Council. Subsequent to your meeting, we met with stakeholders that included both market rate developers, for-profit developers, included representatives from Council Dennis Slattery, from the Planning Commission, Alan Harper, and your own Rich Rohde on behalf of the Housing and Human Services Commission. So that input, in addition to what was presented at the study session, influenced the creation of the draft ordinance that was included in your packet. And that ordinance is what we are reviewing tonight. Largely, it is consistent with much of what was presented to you back in July. And Linda and I are also going to be working in concert to give this presentation, and I'll introduce her to talk about the project objectives.
Thank you, Brandon. So a lot of this is familiar to you. We've talked pretty extensively about this at the last meeting. Was it the last meeting? That seems like a long time ago. And you have been there all along for this whole process. And so you've seen how it has unfolded, and the pretty much the reasons why we have undertaken this project. But generally, you know, those objectives are outlined here. And maybe one of the biggest pieces was that providing the predictability and the clarity. Mostly, it began as having a more predictable methodology for the homeowners, because that was the issue that sort of brought this to the fore, and the issue of the HOA costs and how we calculated the formula. So that was really what predicated the big change. But as part of that, it absolutely made sense for us to sort of look back at the years of feedback we had received from all of the consumers of this program. So not just the homeowners, but the home buyers, the real estate agents, the mortgage brokers, the assessors, all of the people who have touched these units in one way or another. And of course, not the least of which, the development community, which included both for-profit and nonprofit affordable housing developers. You know, we often talk in this commission about why we have these goals and why these units don't get built. And the truth of the matter for us is that we're not developers, so we don't know why. We can guess at it, and we can think, like, we offer this money, we offer these incentives, but they don't seem to be enough. What is it that compels these developments, or what keeps them from doing these things when we're giving them, you know, these incentives, or providing these incentives and giving them this grant funding? And so I think this was part of that process, is that on our end, we see all the things that we are doing to promote it. On the other side of the counter, we don't see what it is that is the barrier to them doing that kind of development. And so I think a big part of this, the objectives of this program, was to see in what ways we could get out of the way and make it easier for developers to build the housing stock that we want and the housing types that we want, and to make it a more efficient and effective process for them as well. So I think that was my long-winded way of saying, I think this commission has been here the whole time asking these questions and seeing what we can do to address it. And I think this is a big part of that. So I don't know if you guys want to go over this too in depth, just because we've talked about it a lot before, how we have changed the formula, why we chose to go to a fixed rate formula over a lot of different ways of calculating the sales price, making it more predictable, being more efficient and effective for all of the parties involved. And then the thing that I want to highlight here, you know, we came to you and we put out a bunch of recommendations and sort of ideas that we had had over these years of gathering feedback. And then we had the stakeholders meeting, which there was a memo in your packet and you got to see the feedback that we received at that meeting. And one of the important pieces of feedback that we received was regarding how we calculate the maximum rental rates. And so we had tried to simplify it by going with this straight with the home program, because HUD figures those out every year and calculates them based on the income guidelines for your area and bedroom size, and it would be consistent with other funding. It was brought to our attention that at times, not all the time, but sometimes the low-income housing tax credit program has different rents than the home program. And they actually, I guess, can be mixed in together. But many of our large-scale affordable housing developments utilize low-income housing tax credits. And so we wanted to just make it consistent for them and to not make it more difficult. So we added the low-income housing tax credit index, essentially, that rents could be tied to that funding source if that funding source was what was used and requires rents that are different from the home rents. And then we increased the asset limitation, which we've talked about in the past. But certainly, if any of these things, if you have any questions or if I'm going over things too quickly, just ask. I'm turning it over to Brandon now to talk about land use stuff.
Rich, did you have a question?
Well, I was just looking as we go forward. I think if people have questions, raise your hand vigorously and we'll get them in. But if you can, we've seen these a bunch of times. There's one place where there's been some kind of changes. If you could just kind of move quickly through them, and then we'll see where questions
arise. We'll do so. I actually, this is a slightly different presentation than you saw before. We cut out probably 2/3 of the slides, so it should be a little more abbreviated. Essentially, though, to make sure everything's covered for the record, there are changes to the base density calculation. This is a case where if a property is annexing and a portion of it is in a floodplain or steep slopes, currently that's counted as the lot area. This would exclude environmentally constrained lands from that calculation, which then has the effect of reducing the developable land and as such the proportion of affordable units. One of the bigger changes in the ordinance amendment is to eliminate the 60% area median income category for affordable housing, and this applies to both ownership and rentals. Rentals still can come in at 60% AMI or below, but they would be qualifying at that 80% AMI or below, and essentially 20% of the project would have to meet that standard with that equivalency value of 1.25. And going forward, projects that proposed ownership at 60% and below would not qualify for a greater equivalency value. This was brought up by Habitat for Humanity and their application that their target audience for ownership often is at the 70% AMI level. So these are straightforward, and I know there may be questions regarding these. The affordable housing development timing, this allows for transfer of land to an affordable housing provider to satisfy the timing requirement. Under the current code, it does stipulate that the affordable housing units have to be metered in concurrent with the market rate units. And in this scenario, if a market rate developer gave or transferred title of land to an affordable housing provider, that would be considered satisfying that requirement. That was seen as beneficial by affordable housing providers at the stakeholder meeting because once they acquire the land, that can help them apply for grants to develop it. And so having it transferred to them at the front end of a project is helpful. It's helpful for market rate developers because market rate developers don't then have any ability to ensure that the affordable housing is grant funded. And as such, they're not held to what is a competitive cycle for development of affordable housing. Affordable housing distribution, the change proposed in the ordinance would remove the requirement that it be distributed through the project. Again, this was covered in that stakeholder memo where there was general consensus, although acknowledging the value for social justice to ensure that affordable housing is not segregated from a development. There was a general consensus that the scale and size of projects in Ashland was small, and as such, it didn't lend itself to creating wholly low-income neighborhoods that are clearly distinguished from what is otherwise a small development project.
And Brandon, I would also jump in and just say that when we looked back at, you know, resolving issues that have been brought up over the years, this has not been an issue that has ever been brought up by occupants of affordable housing. So it didn't seem like it was a barrier for social justice that it hadn't caused issues in the past. And yet it has been a barrier for affordable housing developers in that they would have to request an exception and that could open them up essentially to an appeal.
Yeah, and on that line, past affordable housing developments that were done concurrent with market rate annexations and zone changes have received exceptions from the Planning Commission, the City Council, in order to locate those units, whether that's Rice Park. That's a great example of part of Verde Village where the 15 affordable housing units were transferred at the front end to an affordable housing provider, actually built before the market rate development, and received an exception to not be distributed through the project due to their being a different housing type, which gets to the next issue that in order to kind of promote a variety of housing types, currently the standard indicates that units have to be comparable unit types. Here we're looking at maintaining the requirement that there be a comparable number of bedrooms so that you can accommodate households of equal size, but adding more flexibility that different unit types could be considered, be they townhomes, condos, apartments. So for instance, a full single family detached residential development, the affordable housing units needn't be detached single family units. They could theoretically be apartment complexes if that's what the affordable housing partner was looking at developing. Or they could be townhomes if there was a greater efficiency and cost in developing those than larger single family detached. This next one is a very simple one in terms of the annexation density bonus. The city of Ashland changed the density bonus from 25% to 35% for affordable housing. That change is not reflected in annexations, although that is allowable within the city limits for performance standards. So we're looking at increasing the density bonus to promote more affordable housing as part of annexations as well. And this is an area that I'm sure there'll be some discussion on in terms of the terms of affordability. Initially, when we came to you back in July, we had proposed taking the 60-year term of affordability that applied equally to both rentals and ownership affordable housing units and reducing that to a 30-year term of affordability. In speaking with the nonprofit affordable housing developers that developed rental housing, namely the Housing Authority of Jackson County, they indicated that for their applications to be competitive for state funds or for low-income housing tax credits, they universally propose a 60-year term of affordability. And as such, they did not see a value necessarily in reducing it to 30 years because their projects would likely come in at 60 years anyway. So that allowed staff with that feedback to suggest a term of affordability that differs between rental and ownership, providing a 60-year term for ownership or for rental rather, and a 30-year term for ownership housing. When the Planning Commission, and I believe this commission as well, was talking about a 30-year term for ownership, there was some general concern in terms of the value that the city is adding on to a project by allowing for annexation. Was there some measure that the city could essentially get an equity recapture if a unit were to leave the program after 30 years or in some way promote it to stay in the program for longer? That would be done separate from the land use ordinance. It would be part of the resolution for affordable housing 2006-13, which was included in your packets. But in that resolution, staff has internally discussed the potential of modifying that resolution to, again, have that 30-year period of affordability, which is what the resolution calls for currently for a waiver of SDCs. And currently, at the end of 30 years, those SDCs are fully forgiven. The modification that could be considered through amending that resolution would be to create a recapture provision where after 30 years, for the first 30 years, a unit could not leave the program. And so it would remain affordable for that period of time. If a unit wanted to leave the program on year 30, the amendment could be presented that they pay off all of the SDCs that were granted to that unit with interest. So if interest went up at 1.5% a year, ENR stands for Engineering News Record, which is the index that's used for transportation SDCs and water SDCs. So they would owe $21,883 on year 30 and would have to pay that back to leave the program. As an incentive to stay in the program, essentially for every year staying beyond 30 years, they would get a 1/30th reduction in the amount of SDC owed until year 60, when it would be fully forgiven. So this would be a substantive change for the SDC program to recapture those SDCs for units that are not staying in the program for a full 60 years. But again, if a unit was required to be affordable for 30 years and on year 30 decided to exit the program and become a market rate unit, they could do so. But under this scenario, if this were approved, they would have to pay back $21,883 in SDCs to the city. So that was, again, something that we hadn't talked about before. One that you're familiar with is the five-year supply of land. Again, this is moving forward as part of the ordinance before you to essentially eliminate the requirement that annexations of residential land demonstrate there's less than a five-year supply in the city. With this section removed, any residential development proposal that is proposing a development that's in conformance with the underlying zoning could be annexed without having to demonstrate that there's a deficit of land within the city. And as such, that promotes the annexation of residential property. And this is the last slide I have. And again, we can go back to any of those prior slides for questions. So the Housing and Human Services Commission, you're looking at this tonight. You've got the ordinance in front of you. We're looking to you to provide a recommendation to the City Council in terms of the whether to approve, amend, or deny the application that's currently being presented to you. If you have any suggested changes for the ordinance, those could be provided as part of your recommendation as well. Your recommendation, in addition to going to the City Council, will present it to the Planning Commission, who will be reviewing the ordinance on October 27th, and then we will go to Council for first and second reading in November and December. With final adoption of the ordinance wouldn't occur until 2021 in January, 30 days after second reading. And in that interim, we'd also be presenting a potential resolution 2006-13 amendments to align with the land use ordinance that you're reviewing. Those things that relate to the maximum resale and the maximum rents, those have to be changed in the resolution as well. And so we would do that on the heels of first reading so that that can come back for adoption prior to implementation of the ordinance. So that concludes my presentation, but obviously available for questions, and we'll take copious notes in terms of comments.
Brandon, that was very nice. That was very efficient. So I think that was well presented. Let's open it up for discussions and questions.
I have a question.
Hey, Echo.
So, again, I think it's just for information. Two things. I assume that there's some reason, officially, that there can't be a mixture of manufactured and mobile homes mixed in with stick-built units in these developments. Am I correct about that?
I don't believe there is a limitation. Yeah, we do allow if a property has less than 10% slope, which most of the urban growth boundary does for annexation, you can put a manufactured house on a single family lot within the city of Ashland. So if an applicant had that as part of their proposal to do that, that would be something that could be approved. There are some limitations on the manufactured house in terms of and I don't have them all on the tip of my tongue, but really skirting around it so that there's, it's permanently affixed to the foundation in some manner. Those kind of building code issues would apply. But this commission and planning commission, and ultimately council, modified those standards probably about 4 years ago, if my memory serves, to remove some of the minimum size requirements for manufactured homes, pitch of roof, materials, those kind of things were previously in there. A requirement for a garage was previously in there. That was removed. So some of those would make that straightforward. Additionally, if an annexation is for R2 zone property, manufactured dwelling parks are an allowable use within R2 zoning. You know, we don't often see that from a market rate side, but a property that is currently a manufactured home park that is not within the city that was going to annex in an R2 zone could do so. And
it's obviously on my mind because of the fire.
Yeah.
And I know it's on Rich's mind too, for obvious reasons and personal reasons as well. I doubt it would actually happen in Ashland because I think a market rate buyer probably would be put off by being adjacent to either a manufactured or an actual mobile home, but it's good to know that at least it's conceivable. Although I think obviously for economic reasons, it's probably unlikely. The other question I had, and most of what I read, we'd read before, so I don't have a lot to say. I live personally on marginal land in a little development that was built in 1980, originally part of the Billings land grant for the entire north end of town. I doubt it would be buildable today, frankly. But I was struck by the part of the revision about being allowed to put the affordable units on the less marketable, less valuable section of a development. And since I live on less valuable land, that caught my attention. I wonder what the definition of less valuable is. I think I know, but Brandon, what is the
definition? Yeah, so again, what you're referring to was a comment that was made at the stakeholder meetings in terms of a private market developer looking at, if we have to include affordable housing, we don't necessarily want to include it in the locations that would have the greatest return per housing unit, mm-hmm. because then they could put the higher value market rate units on that land that has a greater view, or on land that has, for instance, a creekside. Verde Village might be a good example, if you're mm-hmm. familiar with that. Many of the higher value homes are on the creek. Some of the lower income or smaller units are on the interior of the development, which aren't as high value as those that are adjacent to open space. So again, that's not really codified anywhere in the ordinance. I should stipulate that. It was a comment as to why the distribution requirement may have impediments in terms of maximizing the return to help subsidize the affordable units, was the comment that was received.
I just wanted to be sure I understood that correctly. Thank you.
So are there other comments before we move to Heidi?
I just want to compliment you and Linda, Brandon, for taking the initiative to have those meetings, those stakeholder meetings. I also feel that you really considered this commission's feedback in your notes and in the areas that you made changes to. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate the flexibility and the creative thought that went into making options within different topics. And thank you. I think this will help us get more affordable housing here. So no,
thank you. Definitely drafting an ordinance is an iterative process. And so the more feedback that we get into it early, when we get to this point, you're not seeing it all newly, which I think helps both the people that it's going to apply to understand it in terms of the for market and nonprofit developers, as well as decision makers like yourself that have to weigh in and see if it's actually achieving its stated purpose. So thank you for that.
Well, I have a commission question. Is Linda, are you still with us? She went out because she couldn't participate. Oh, you are?
No, do you mean Linda Rapond?
Linda Rapond, yes.
Yes, I am here.
Oh, good. Okay, thanks. I just wanted to check. Everybody's got a chance to weigh in on this issue. I'll just suggest, in somewhat agreeing with Heidi, I think I was opposed to the changing to the 30-year limit and keeping the 60-year. And I think the compromise that it came out with of keeping it on rental units, and I think that makes sense with the clawback for the system development charges. I think that's a good compromise in terms of doing that. My second comment is just very general, but we have looked to have housing in Ashland that is interspersed with all the housing, so we don't have a low-income neighborhood. And I was thinking that that the issue that we made about disbursement kind of changes that a little bit, and I don't mind it. But I was over looking at the Snowberry development that's happening. They're putting in 60 more units behind Snowberry. There's going to be, 120 units all in one clump there. Another place that we could be building housing perhaps would be in the Croman area. I'm worried that we may end up not with dispersed housing, but with areas, I mean, you can't even see it now. Those houses look so nice, but are we going to end up with low-income people in certain portions of Ashland as opposed to having people spaced out? That was my worry. And it doesn't have to do with how we're going to vote on this, but how we think about things going forward, I guess. Echo.
So this goes back to a conversation that I got distracted from about 6 weeks ago about the Trump administration changes to the fair housing requirements that included, Linda Reed knows this better than anybody, that required that kind of dispersal throughout the community. And so this is going to continue to be an issue because whatever's happening at the national level affects this issue of creating segregated low-income neighborhoods. We'll see what happens after January 20, I guess.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Echo, I think that's a really important point. And I do get concerned about like the Snowberry development and how that's another very large piece of flat land that's easily developable. And one thing that I think, you know, that's part of that social justice lens that we use for fair housing specifically is that there are some pieces that are written into the state funding mechanisms that add that piece to it, which would be like they want the developments to be within a certain distance of transportation. It totally makes sense for that to happen. But if you're in a town like Ashland where the bus line is, up one main road and down a side road and then back down the other main road, you know you have to be within a half mile of that distance. So, it really encourages a clustering, which on one hand makes sense, but on another hand, maybe we should look at it with more of a social justice lens at that larger state level.
I just thought about something else I should have thought about before now. Because of the fire. And I've been really focused on the mobile home park issue. And that one of those issues is the issue of ingress and egress routes in those large developments. A friend of mine got completely burned out of Bear Lake Estates there at exit 24. Only one ingress egress point into that mobile home park. Mm-hmm. You could have very similar issues with a large development like Snowberry, even if it was stick built. And I assume the Planning Commission is probably the appropriate body for addressing that kind of issue. But it's something that just occurred to me that I have concerns about with low income developments or affordable units, even if they're workforce level housing. So I assume that's going to get attention.
Yeah, I can speak to that just a little bit. The Transportation System Plan is a guiding document similar to our housing element for in our comprehensive plan for housing. The Transportation System Plan does outline a grid of street systems. And in the case of Snowberry, there is a proposed east-west connection from Clay Street to Tolman that would happen when the property to the north develops. It does end up being piecemeal in terms of when property is developed, the culmination of the entire street system, but we do have connectivity standards that do require, ultimately upon build out, connections, multiple connections. And that is also true of annexations of developments. For instance, the proposed annexation on the north side of, or on 99, would have two points of ingress and egress on that property as part of the conceptual proposal that's going to be reviewed by council in the coming month.
Thank you.
So would someone like to make a motion approving the affordable housing program revisions?
I'll take a stab at it. Okay. Let's see, I move that the commission recommend the amendments to resolution 2006-13, amending the affordable housing program standards, or whatever that right word is. Is that
Brandon?
Get a point of clarification. We're not currently proposing any amendments to 2006-13. Okay. What is being proposed is amendments to the land use ordinance regarding conversion of multifamily rental housing into for purchase housing, affordable housing standards, and approval standards for zone changes and annexations.
So it's the land. Echo, can you just make that your motion?
Yes, thank you,
Brandon. Okay, thank you, Brandon. And a second?
I'll second that.
Thanks, Chris. All in favor of the approving of that recommendations, say aye.
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 Any opposition? Then it's carried. Thank you. Very good program. The next thing on, I guess I have just an update on the CAHOOTS program. And we all know that we've been concerned or been looking at how we could establish a crisis, mobile crisis team in Ashland or in Jackson County based on the CAHOOTS model. And I guess just a quick two updates is there's going to be a candidate forum on this sponsored by NAMI on October 3rd. And so they're going to be talking to the mayors of Ashland and the mayors of Medford and the legislative candidates and the county candidates about that. So that's one of the things. And I would say that the other part is there's a cohort of nursing students that are going to be working on this issue in Ashland from OHSU. And the effort is to work with our local police chief and regionally to look at how somewhere in the county we would have a consulting contract with Tim Black from CAHOOTS to think about what we could do in our county. So that's the update that I would have at this point. So the next part, Linda provided us some new information just very recently, but it's looking at the utility assistance recommendations, kind of an update on that, that we had initially made. And I think we've made some good progress on that. And that's what, Linda, do you want to highlight those?
Well, I can certainly just go over what was in the in the memo that the finance department provided. That you all hopefully received. Let's see here. I had it open on my desktop.
Before you go through them, let me just see, did everybody have a chance? They came recently. Did everybody have a chance to read those? Is there anybody that needs to have those reviewed in detail?
No, I just have a...
Jackie?
I just have a just something I want to note. And that is that I'm listed as being on the ad hoc group that worked on the utility assistance, and I was not able to attend the meeting, but Ken Gudger from Aura, he did attend. So I just want to make sure people understand I was not a part of that. And then the second thing, Linda, if you could address it maybe on the memo, I did read it. And the one thing that kind of bothered me was that the hangers that they're going to hang on people's doors, that they're saying they have to use the old hangers first before they are willing to order the new ones to put the agencies to call. And I just have a concern about that.
So I can certainly forward your concern to the utility department. Obviously, I don't have a lot of sway over the utility department, but I'm happy to let them know about your concern.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Linda, do you want to just highlight a couple of the pieces in there that we could think about?
Sure. So I think that there have been some, it sounds to me like they have done some good work on getting awareness of both the utility assistance programs. I mean, it sounds like staff, sorry, I'm looking at it on my computer and talking to you, so I don't know if that looks strange. But it sounds like that there are regular advertisements about the conservation programs and the Roundup program, and when the access comes to town, which they probably won't be doing now, but the access program to help get your reduce your bill. That, I mean, we in Ashland we call it a LEAP, but I think they just call it LEAP in for access. So it sounds like they've done a good job of getting that advertising out there. It also sounds like utility staff really works with the utility customers who are struggling to make sure that they get the information they need and get to where they need to go. So hopefully, Jackie, even though the door hangers haven't been updated, hopefully they're sending people to the right places currently. Because I know, you know, it's just, it's so hard, especially right now with the funding streams like coming in, and we'll have a lot of money for some things, but then money runs out for other things. So kind of steering people to where they could go to get the help that they need. I mean, I know Access got a lot of rent assistance money, but then they got inundated, and so people ended up getting put on a wait list. And I know for some people that can be a real deterrent to continuing to seek that help if it feels like, you know, everyone I call says, you're going to have to wait. I did hear, you know, that the United Way has a lot of funding right now, and I know people are getting there to get funding for utility assistance. So it sounds like the utility department is keeping up on what's going on and sending people to the right places, because people are coming from Ashland to United Way to get help.
Jackie.
Just one more thing I want to add. I was impressed with the fact that Parks and Rec under Michael Black was having live people answering calls, emergency calls on where to get help. And I think that is a model that maybe the utilities department could use, that model to be reaching out, you know, when people call, have a nice list in front of them and do a little person to person to match them to the program that would best help them. Mm-hmm. So maybe you could mention that as well.
Okay.
The person to person.
Well, and you know, part of the reasoning behind that was twofold. One is that people in times of crisis have a very low threshold for, you know, having to go to different places and not finding what they're needing. And it felt like it would be nicer to be able to direct people to the resource that best fit their needs, without having to send them to a bunch of websites and phone calls and, you know, a lot of other process that could just be more than you can handle when you're in that crisis mode. But the other piece of that that I think was really thoughtful was the idea that not everybody had computer access and was just going to be able to go online or go on their smartphone, because they may have lost those devices or they may not have any devices at all. And it could be, you know, as we know, a lot of the victims of the fire were elderly people in the mobile home parks or Latinx communities, and they just may not be as technologically proficient as others. And so having someone there that can look that information up. And I know right after the fire, I was manning that line too, periodically. And I spoke with a lovely woman who was here in Ashland, but her internet had been out for days, like some of you experienced as well, I'm sure. And so even though, you know, we had all those resources on the city's website, she couldn't access any of them. And so having that resource is really nice. And I imagine that some of the people who are experiencing utility bill insecurity are people with disabilities, seniors, people who may not, you know, be as familiar with that technology to get those resources on their own. So thanks for bringing that up, Jackie.
Thank you.
Well, I would just comment that when we first thought about putting this on this agenda, it was as the city was moving from a moratorium to going ahead and looking at redoing shutoffs again. And so I think the concern was, oh my gosh, what will happen? And I think because of the work that the city has done and the recommendations out of this, there doesn't seem to have been like a big number of shutoffs that have happened. This, it seems like the city has handled that. I got a kind of an update from John from St. Vincent, and the number of shutoffs that they've had to help people with has gone down rather than up. And so that was, it was first when we had them going up a year ago that we were concerned. So I think there's some good ways in which this whole focus has helped us move through this. We have to still be alert. The one issue that I couldn't get through that work group, but I just mentioned here that I like, is the expansion of the
the roundup program?
Roundup. And you can round up, and there's people doing that, and we want to encourage that, but the average is 50 cents a month when you round up. And as wonderful as that is, I always thought that we could have a round up to the next $10. So if you had a $242, you'd raise it up to $250. And if you did that, you'd average $5 a month towards that service. And some people, they'll round up whatever. I mean, it isn't going to kill you at $5. 50 cents is nice, but it doesn't raise, we would 10 times the amount of money that we'd have available for people. So anyway, that was just an idea. So Echo.
Two things. Under number four, track signups for assistance programs. A, it says provide periodic reports. Can we get more specific about what periodic means?
We can. So that apparently, and I was not aware of this, that information is tracked and kept. And so really it would just be a matter of me periodically requesting that information and getting it to you.
Yeah, like if it's annually in right. November or something, or whatever makes sense. You.
And I used to do that in a very, I guess I still do, in a very limited way, which is that each year when we when you review and approve the consolidated annual performance evaluation report for the use of CDBG funds, I do generally include how many people benefited from the ALEAP program and then also received discounts from the utility billing program. So I do that annually, but I
can certainly,
and I could certainly do that in a different format.
And then number two, and this is number seven in the memo. First of all, there's a word misusage that's slightly embarrassing. Under 7B, it says consider a higher income threshold for single households as they BARE. That should be BEAR.
Oh, interesting.
Old college professor. I cannot help but proofread. I'm sorry, Chris is now laughing at me because he knows that. But about that, I'm a single household. What does that mean? Most of your single rate payers?
So I have to say, I do not know what that means. What was the thought, any of you who were on the committee? Can you speak a little more about the reasoning behind that? I am not sure.
Just wondered.
So
Heidi, do you want to?
I just wanted to say my concern about Ashland Utilities. First of all, there was sort of a statewide moratorium against cutting off power during COVID. And I think that's probably part of the reason we've seen fewer shutoffs. But in addition to that, there are so many tacked on fees and taxes to our utility bills. I have an interest in finding out what are all those fees, are they really necessary? And how could we more economically deliver water and power to Ashland residents? Because it is so noticeable. And every person on my street who's moved away has cited the cost of utilities in Ashland is so high, I just can't afford to live here anymore. So that's my concern with utility fees in Ashland.
Gina, did you want to say something to that?
No, I just wanted to ditto that. I've heard that so much, Heidi, and I've heard, as a matter of fact, in just this year, three young families moved to Medford because of rent and utilities, you know, so which one do we pay? It's outrageous, and I'm curious about that, too. So I hope soon we'll have an answer.
I think the new city council members may have something to say about that, Gina.
Yeah, I think so too.
Jackie?
I wonder if Linda or Brandon would know a way that we could be educated a little bit about utilities and the costs and just some of the, just make us maybe just more knowledgeable of why it is what it is right now, to what Heidi is saying, and that we've heard from so many community members, so we could think about how to help in terms of recommendations and moving forward. Who would be the one who could maybe give us a little more education on utility, how the utility bill works and all of that?
Well, I am not sure that I'm the best suited to explain why all of the individual fees are on the utility bill. I do know that some of the base rate fees for electricity and water are actually lower than Medford. But I think what you're referring to is some of the fixed costs that are on there for street user fees, for maintenance of streets throughout the city. And so some of these can be in terms of expectations of our community as to how to maintain storm drain systems, how to maintain streets, wastewater treatment plant, electric infrastructure. And so those are all paid for in terms of the utility rates, obviously, but also the long-term maintenance of those existing facilities is not necessarily rate-driven, it's those other fees. Additionally, the public safety support fee, I think it was called, and the Ashland Fire and Rescue 3/4-inch fee. I'm remembering from council meetings that, in all honesty, I might not have been paying complete attention, but those fees were tacked on to utility fees in order to fund fuels management within the area around the community, which again is an individual interest that citizens of Ashland were looking to support, and the council at the time wanted to find a way to fund those fuels reduction programs. But again, I think that the utility division obviously can give a clear background on how all of those fees were initiated, which ones are discretionary and which ones aren't. I know that some of the fees, such as the water utility fees that are fixed on it, come out of the water master plan that was done for the water system and improvements that are projected over the next 30-year period, if I remember. So some of those fees are being collected in anticipation of maintenance costs, not from last year, but, you know, in 2025, 2030, and so that it'll accumulate enough funds to actually replace a water system that will be reaching end of life. So those are some of my understandings, but again, I don't know all the nuances behind it.
Right. I remember what the 99.25 is. The gentleman from St. Vincent de Paul's that came and spoke to us about the water and utility rates for Ashland, that the charges for water, that was the baseline fee before you ever use any water. So it's the lowest it can get is $99.25. And what that discussion was about was it's a disproportionate impact on single person households because they're paying the long-term tax as well, but it's a bigger imposition on them because they're just one person.
Great job. I
think we've identified an area that we can, when we ever get time, that we can explore about the progressivity of utility and fees in Ashland, which is a good discussion, but it's a long one. So I think we're going to go ahead and move to general announcements and updates. And one of the updates that we wanted to hear from, and we'll get a number of them, but is from, we had a work group on the Hardesty property. And Gina is here somewhere who can give us a bit of an update on what's happening there.
So thank you, Rich. And something I'd like to regress just a little bit. And if we do have an opportunity to talk about the utilities, I think the person to invite to the table would be Adam Hanks. He was, he and I had a little bit of a discussion on that once, and it was cut short, but he had a lot to contribute. So just wanted to put that out there. Okay, now on to the Hardesty property. Thanks, guys. I'm glad that we're having a discussion, is because I just had some notes on this. And I wanted to bring it to the table and ask all of you. You are all experts on this. So something that some time ago, you know, we walked the property, we saw the property. Some of the partners were there, Rogue Retreat, Jobs with Justice, United Way, La Clinica, City Council, Julie was there. So it was a very productive walkthrough. Elizabeth with Peace House. And something that I wanted to discuss is that, I don't know if we all knew this, but the city owns the property and the county has zoning rights. That was a bit of a problem. So the city owns the property, the county has the zoning rights. So the fastest way that I believe, when I ask some of our partners, the fastest way to get this done is to have the city annex the property rather than to have to go through the land use board, and that could take forever to get that done and legal fees. So if the city were to annex the property, they would then have the right, we would have the right of usage. So that is my understanding. And I know, Brandon, I don't know if you know, if you could speak to the zoning about this.
I can speak to that. The Hardesty property is not within the city limits, as you know, but it's also not within our urban growth boundary. So the city cannot annex the property unless through a regional problem solving, we were to expand our urban growth boundary to include that property. And that is a multi-year process, would be less expeditious than going through the county for allowance of use of the property. You know, when the property was purchased, it was identified to council in the council memo that it was outside of our urban growth boundary, but due to the intended use of the property, it didn't really need to be developable in that way. So it is not, in order to annex property, it has to meet, be one within the urban growth boundary, be within adjacent to the city limits. Although it's adjacent to the city limits, it's not within the UGB. So in that sense, it cannot be annexed unless the urban growth boundary was changed. And that would require agreement between the city, the county, and ultimately the state in advance of moving that boundary before an annexation could be proposed.
So then if I hear you right, then you are telling me that the city doesn't own this at all. The county does.
No, the city owns the property. The city purchased the property from the Hardesty Estate, and the city can use it for uses that are approved by the county. You know, it's similar. The Imperatus property across the freeway is another property that the city owns, but it is farmland effectively and can't be used for urban development. An urban growth boundary is the extent at which a city can develop and urbanize, and this is outside of that urbanizable area. And so in that sense, even though the city owns it, it can't be annexed into the city without, again, a preceding expansion of the urban growth boundary.
So because, so ultimately, either way, I'd have to do the urban growth boundary. We couldn't go to the county.
No, for the, another, an example, the county approved for the city the use of that property to use as a yard for street division. And I'm forgetting what other uses were approved, but basically storage of material. So the city had to make an application to the county to use it for that. And that was ultimately approved by the county. If the city as property owner wanted to do another use that was allowable within that rural zone, they could apply for that use with Jackson County. What I don't know is whether what your concept is for the development is an allowable use within that rural zone or within those environmentally constrained lands, which was part of the city's application for use as a storage yard, had to address the floodplain, which encompasses a considerable part of the property, and show that it wouldn't be encroaching on those areas. Due to displacement of water. And Paula Brown worked on that application. I had a small hand in it when it went forward, met with the county once, and this is a couple of years back. But again, if the city wanted to submit an application to the county to develop it according to county standards, the county would be the jurisdiction that approved it and inspected it, and the city would be like any other property owner in that regard. Mm-hmm.
So the city would have to go to the county. I got you just taking some notes. Thank you. I'm glad that we could have that input, because sometimes I look at this, though, you guys, where we are right now with displaced people, so many unhoused people, and nobody's making allowances. We're stuck in this peanut butter, and we're just stuck, and nobody's making allowances. Even having Dennis Slattery have this conversation with me, he didn't bring that part up. So I'm glad that you shared that with me.
Yeah, and it may also relate to part of something that Echo brought up earlier in this meeting, related to City of Talent looking for flexibility from the county or state in terms of use of property outside their urban growth boundary as an emergency response. Currently, transitional housing development, which is this emergency housing that we're talking about, can only be located under state law within urban growth boundaries. And so I know that we raised that issue with our state representative, Department of Land Conservation, as planners, as to can the state look at flexibility so lands outside the urban growth boundary could be used in response to the Alameda fire. But again, they brought up that might be a legislative change in order to allow that. Sorry to
echo. Unmute.
Okay, now I am. Sorry. So I was just looking at the language in that talent document, and they're referring to it as temporary, allowing temporary emergency accommodations. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read through it totally carefully. But I have the same question about whether or not there's a way to speed up the process using a state of using a declaration of emergency sort of exception. I don't know.
Do you know what? I was in my Luli class the other evening, and Josh talked about, and Pam Marsh was a part of it also, and they talked about the talent in the urban growth boundary, and they said the temporary thing. Well, if it's temporary, what is it going to look like after things are built up? How do you put it back in? Josh said they were looking at probably about 10 to 15 acres. And so they were saying, oh, it won't be too much, but about 10 to 15 acres. And I just look at this now as it's an emergency. It's not just, so what are we going to do with this property? So I echo, you know, what we have to speed this up and put it somewhere on a fast track.
Actually, I'm just looking a little bit more in detail at the talent language, and they're actually talking about using land within their urban growth boundary, not outside of it. So I think in this case, since the county has jurisdiction over city-owned property, that the county would have to allow temporary emergency housing. And getting our county commission to support that seems unlikely to me, frankly.
Heidi?
I think in this time of crisis, we really should be promoting in Ashland that we have an ordinance that allows ARUs or ADUs, whichever you want to call it, just additional dwelling units, additional residential units, and encourage people to consider making their garages into apartments to help supply the huge need of unhoused people in our region. I don't know if the city ever does public service announcements but I would think now would be the time for that, because I think not a lot of people understand that we already have that ordinance.
Brandon or Linda, do you guys want to say anything about that?
Heidi is right. We do outright permit accessory residential units on all residential property. And so we do have more ARUs built in Ashland than probably any other community our size. But nonetheless, reaching out and letting people know that it is an option to do a conversion. I mean, they can get started now, usually get building permits and build it and make it habitable space takes time. So I think that is probably a good public announcement that could be made. Another one that I will bring up, and it's premature to do so, but I'm among friends. The state is looking at communities that are less than over 10,000 square feet, 10,000 people up to 25,000 as being required to provide allowances for duplexes in single family zones. I think it would be appropriate for the city of Ashland to really accelerate that and not wait until December of 21 to have those rules in place, but begin the effort to make duplexes allowable where all single families are. And that's different than ARUs because they can be of, you know, not half the size of the primary unit. They can both be the same size, where units that could be partitioned down the middle could be done so more expediently if they're habitable space on both sides already. So again, I think that would be one of those emergency provisions that could move through the land use process. Still does require public notice. All of those things have not been waived by the governor, and the public hearing requirements haven't been waived as well. So those aren't things that would be necessarily done by executive order, but would come before this commission and then the planning commission and council for approval, similar to the affordable housing standards that you just reviewed. So I went off topic there a little bit, but I agree with Heidi on.
Well, is there other discussion Is there any...
have an announcement?
Well, yes, we're going to go to other announcements. I just want to see if there's any other next steps about this that we should do. We have a committee that's sort of looking at the Hardesty property that they could kind of take all of this in and have another update when we meet next that would maybe incorporate some of these thoughts. Does that sound all right, Gina?
Yes, that sounds good to me, and I appreciate the information, Brandon, and something about me, I'm tenacious. So the more I know, the more I can push forward. It might take a year or 2 years, but we will always have a population that's unhoused.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and on the Hardesty property, as well as other properties within Ashland, either city-owned, SOU-owned, or larger sites that could accommodate some of that, what the state calls transitional housing accommodations, that emergency housing. The city is forwarding to the state DLCD representative 5 properties, Hardesty included, as potentials that could be used for that. However, they've got a whole criteria in terms of whether they have utilities, whether they are within an urban growth boundary because of that Oregon revised statute 446.265, if you're tenacious and want to look up the actual state law. That is part of what the state will be looking at in terms of where to site those in response to the Alameda fire.
Thank you. Thank you.
Linda, did you have an update?
I just wanted to ask Brandon if the issue of moving forward with duplexes is something that should be initiated by this commission or by the planning commission. Would action from us make a difference in that?
Yeah, the land use code stipulates that the city council and the planning commission can initiate ordinance amendments. So I think that's something that Bill Molnar will be bringing to the planning commission to request initiation of that. I spoke with Bill about it and we're looking at initiating it, but staff has to get that direction from council or the planning commission. As much as I'd like to go to you guys, it's pretty clear in the ordinance that those are the two governing bodies that have that power and duty.
Thank you. I also just want to point out that the letter we received in our public comment at the beginning of this meeting was really reiterating what this conversation is about, is that it's really time to make exceptions to policies, procedures, laws, rules, the ways that we have said no, and find a way to say yes. And I just wholeheartedly agree with that. I agree with what Gina's saying, with what Heidi's saying, what Echo's saying. We need to, as a city and as a region, do everything we can to make it work, because we're in very desperate times. That's my main input.
So, Linda, do you have a staff update?
No, I could talk about a variety of different things. Things have been very busy on the staff side, obviously, due to COVID and due to fire. And I would probably, I know you guys have asked in the past, and I believe that we talked about it a little bit at the last meeting, but we talked at the beginning of this meeting about the additional funding we've received, and we have touched on some of the activities that we have funded in support of COVID, which I'll just reiterate, we did, we supported Aura with hotel motel vouchers at the beginning. And then we also supported the reopening of the shower trailer. We supported the meals through Peace House ongoing. And let's see, is that everything? Oh, and then we also supported rental assistance through Aura. And so with all the money that we have received and the exceptions that we received to money that we already had but had not allocated, we had a total of about $625,000, and we've expended, oh, that's weird. That's not right. Sorry, I'm just looking at this, and this doesn't seem to be the most updated one. Anyway, we have expended, I wrote it down on here. about $235,000 at this point. Some of that money is capital money, as we've talked about in the past. It can only be spent on capital projects because it's much older money that we've had in our account for a while. But we did get the mega waiver that allowed us to use the 2019 and the 2019 funds in much much more broad ways that, you know, helps with the needs that are happening now. And the only other thing I would say is, you know, in with the wildfire crisis and sort of staff realigning to address the urgent needs that came about because of that, and thinking about ways that, you know, one disaster on top of another crisis was, you know, causing different needs and changing those needs every day and trying to address them every day. It seems as though there have been an outpouring, as we've all experienced, of community support, but also community support for, you know, ideas like you're expressing now. And I think that there are just amazing people right now putting a lot of innovative ideas out there and really exploring that work. So I feel really hopeful that in the very near future, we're going to start to see a lot of help for these populations who have been displaced, a lot of interesting and innovative and creative housing options. So I'm not with any of those efforts because most of them are not really happening here in Ashland, but I get to be on the periphery of those discussions. And so I am hearing about a lot of interest and support, and it's amazing to me. This might be the time in our experience that the community is so supportive of affordable housing and just innovative housing and housing types that generally we don't think about rebuilding, like manufactured housing. And so I'm really heartened to see that. And I feel like there's just really good people working on this and that it's going to get done. That would be my
opinion. Are there other updates that people or any announcements that people want to make? And then we'll talk about the next meeting. Echo.
So I've been tracking the mobile home issue specifically. Pam Marsh made a brief announcement on a Facebook page, not elaborated on yet, but she's holding at 4 o'clock next Wednesday some kind of Zoom meeting, conference, public forum, something on mobile homes. She said she was going to have more information on her Representative Pam Marsh Facebook page. And I just looked at it. I'm not seeing it there yet, but that's coming up next week. And I think that's gonna be pretty important. She's been really amazing, I think, in getting information out to people. I've been very grateful. I also really wanna thank city staff. I know we all want to. I saw that picture of the guys at the water treatment plant trying to put out the fire when it first started. That was incredibly moving, knowing it looked like they had to like sort of cut down a fence to try to put some water on the point of ignition on that fire. And Linda, all of you on city staff who I know have just been completely slammed and dealing, you know, probably with your own stresses and your own families and friends who've lost so much. Thank you for all that all of you do.
Our next meeting, I think, is October 22nd. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not sure. I'll have to check. I mean, I think so. And at some point, so as many of you will, okay, Brandon is saying yes. As many of you wouldn't have noticed, we did not do the consolidated annual performance evaluation report this month, which normally we would. Because HUD gave us a waiver, thank goodness. So it was delayed for another 90 days. So it will be coming back to you probably in November. Although, you know what the crazy thing about this, so this is the part that I don't understand, but I'll get it squared away before we get there. is that all of our COVID activities go into our 2019, it's a little, just a bureaucratic thing, I guess. We attached it all to our 2019 action plan. That's the HUD said, pick one, 2019 or 2020, and that's the one you have to stick with. So we actually have completed just about all the activities, or at least we will have by December. And so we could report on those and include those in our outcomes for our CAPR, because now I feel like we have to count the COVID outcomes in our CAPR, because that's where the action plan that we put those activities. But then they just gave us more money. So I asked, well, should I put this, all the activities on the 2020 CAPR? And I was told, no, because you amended your 2019, you're just going to keep amending the 2019 and add those activities to that 2019 action plan. So I don't know how many CAPRs I'm going to have to do for this, but we'll see. Anyway, I'll get clarification, but then we'll get to hear about all the good work everyone's been doing. So that'll be exciting.
So if we meet on the fourth Thursday, it'll be October 22nd. And I was kind of responding, echo to, and you all, to the spirit of the person that made the response. And I think our city is looking to us for more than just approving bureaucratic things, as much as that's nice, that we also have a responsibility at this time, which is both for emergency housing, and then what kind of housing are we actually envisioning and producing in Ashland. And I think there's a lot of good stories, but we need more. And so I'm hoping that at least if we don't have too much of any other issues, that we could take at least some period of that time to kind of look at and analyze our housing needs and the emergency needs in Ashland, and at least have our Housing and Human Service Commission having an action plan or something going forward that we're thinking about. So that's my hope. Okay. Are there other issues? I know people, this has been a long, I'm just hardly holding up here, but this has been a long meeting. Are there anything else that we need to do before we adjourn? Chris.
So I just wanted to make a quick update announcement. Heidi kind of alluded to, you know, what's SOU's position with the response, and I can maybe answer partially to that. The last time I got an update was probably about a week ago, but my understanding is that they are using Cox Hall as a way to you know, provide shelter to the community as well as SOU students. The last count that I heard was around 70 students that was impacted. And I'm talking about, you know, 70 students and family. So not just, you know, just the original 70 students. So that was the last count. Of course, that number will probably continue to go up, but I will update you as I also gather information. I'm hoping to kind of streamline that information from our director of housing here. So that's all.
Chris, we still don't have an official SOU liaison on this commission, although you know stuff and I know old stuff. And I did have somebody who was interested in being that liaison a few months ago, but then the pandemic hit and our meetings were so disrupted, I didn't actually follow up on it. But it's something I haven't forgotten about. Although, you know, you're actually sort of on campus, whatever that means these days. So thank you for that.
Well, everybody, thank you all for hanging in there. I think we did some good. I appreciate everybody's participation, but we're going to just wave our hands and adjourn the meeting, and thanking our staff again for helping facilitate. Hi, everybody.